Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On November 3, 2020, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Jones v. Mississippi. The question before the court was whether the Eighth Amendment requires a sentencing authority to make a finding that a juvenile is permanently incorrigible before imposing a sentence of life without parole. Joining us to discuss this case's oral argument is Mark Levin. Mr. Levin is the Chief of Policy and Innovation for the Right on Crime Initiative at the Texas Public Policy Foundation.
Thanks so much. And I know this oral argument was what everyone was on pins and needles for today. But I'm going to start with just a summary. And then after that, I'll talk a little bit about the how originalism applies in this context or might apply, depending on your perspective. And then three trends in this area in terms of where states have been going. And included in that, I'll talk about some recent polling on the issue of juvenile life without parole and alternatives to it, in case you haven't had enough polling in recent days. And then finally, some of the policy issues involving recidivism, cost, and other factors that affect the way the public looks at this and the way policymakers look at it. So, you know, I'll just start by saying, of course, whether something's a good idea from a policy perspective is not the same question of whether the Constitution requires a particular policy outcome. So the oral argument today in Jones versus Mississippi really focused on a very narrow question, which is whether the court was required to make a finding, explicit or implicit, that the youth is permanently incorrigible. And in this instance, we were dealing with a 15-year-old person, Brett Jones, who killed his grandfather at the age of 15, and he was sentenced in 2005, and then he had a resentencing in 2015, and the court at that point decided to keep in place the life without parole sentence. And just to take you a little bit through the oral argument now, I'll kind of explain the back and forth that we saw. And obviously, it's quite interesting because I know many people wanted to see how the newest justice, Amy Coney Barrett, what her comments would be in this regard, and I'll certainly get to that. But at the outset, the attorneys for the defendant basically said, look, the court at the rehearing, you know, basically did not comply with the letter of the law in Montgomery, which basically extended the Miller decision, because the court did not say that it was using as a dispositive factor whether Brett Jones was permanently incorrigible, which is essentially to say whether he was incapable of rehabilitation at any time in his future life. Chief Justice Roberts asked, you know, what type of finding the defense would like to see. That exchange kind of revealed that the defense was not finding a formal finding, because actually in Montgomery, it said that, it implied that wasn't necessary, but some state by the judge, for these reasons, I've determined that in this case, Brett Jones is permanently incorrigible. And one of the things to point out is that the Justice Alito got in pretty early into the give and take, and he kind of expressed concerns that go back to his dissent, both in Miller and Montgomery, and really back to what the Eighth Amendment issue is in this case, which is whether this the practice of juvenile life without parole, at least without these explicit considerations, is cruel and unusual punishment. And at one point, Justice Alito said, you want to take us and the courts into very deep psychological waters. He quoted Gandhi in terms of saying Gandhi said no one is beyond redemption, and referenced the good thief on the cross. And so Justice Alito basically asked, how can a judge determine for sure someone over, which could be 50 or 60 years in the future, could never change? And isn't that a really high bar? And the counsel for the defendant essentially said the court would obviously not have a crystal ball, but the court could just cite the reasons based on, the defense counsel said, looking at the nature of the crime, looking at did that youth have a long criminal record, did they show remorse, things like that. And I thought at that point the defense might have missed an opportunity to point out that, you know, this particular finding, just like aggravating and mitigating factors, it's well established in the law, would be not based on proof beyond a reasonable doubt, based on preponderance of the evidence. So yes, of course, you can't say for 100% sure someone won't. There's no way they'll be rehabilitated. You can't know what's going to be in their head decades from now, but perhaps defense counsel could have allayed Justice Alito's concerns a little more by saying, look, it's a preponderance of the evidence standard. So then we went on with Justice Alito trying to kind of, I would say, downplay the whole Miller and Montgomery by saying that we just need to look at what they ultimately held, which was requiring some type of, you know, reasoning before sentencing a juvenile to life without parole, and that we shouldn't kind of delve too deeply into the language of Montgomery, where it does talk about permanent incorrigibility finding. At this point, Justice Sotomayor got in, and it was kind of surprising because she had some tough questions for the defense lawyer, even though, of course, most people would think she will end up on the side of the defense, but basically saying, I think maybe harkening back to her time as a trial court judge, saying, you know, does the trial court judge have to use the magic words? And he did say he was considering the Miller factors, such as, you know, the youth-related circumstances, even though the judge did not reference permanent incorrigibility. And so there was an interesting exchange there. We also then heard from Justice Gorsuch, who brought up the issue of, if we are going to say Montgomery added this new requirement that the permanent incorrigibility issue be dispositive, that would that be a substantive change versus a procedural change under Teague, which would determine whether it was retroactive or not. So there was a fair amount of discussion about that. And I think there was Justice Kavanaugh who got in, brought up the issue of what kind of record does the judge have to establish if we're going to say the judge should have said, made an explicit determination that Brett Jones was permanently incorrigible. And he emphasized the fact that the court was clear in Montgomery, they weren't requiring a formal fact finding. Chief Justice Roberts said, wouldn't just a sentence or two do? And the defense basically agreed with that. And Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who I referenced earlier, she really didn't give too many hints in her questions. They were pretty technical in nature. She asked whether also hypothetically, even if the proper process was followed, the defendant could still raise a challenge to the proportionality of the sentence. And it was a little surprising that the Solicitor General, the Assistant Solicitor General, said that there could be. But ultimately, I don't think that's kind of going to play into the outcome of this. So at the end of the day, as far as where the justices line up, I think it's clear based on their prior dissents, Justice Alito and Justice Thomas will almost certainly, again, determine that cruel and unusual punishment should be looked at in the context of what was considered to be that, so at the time of the founding, and that we should really kind of go back from this decades of jurisprudence that has emphasized the evolving standards of decency. I think Chief Justice Roberts, because he really dominated the beginning with the questions about, you know, what would be enough in terms of the judge's specificity of their findings, I think he's going to take a very narrow approach to the case. And I think that there were some hints that Kavanaugh would be with Roberts in that regard. And of course, Kavanaugh, his closeness with T former Justice Kennedy, who obviously this jurisprudence really stems from him more than any other judge. So I think that might also be suggestive of that, although certainly Justice Kavanaugh is going to be make his up his own mind without regard to Justice Kennedy. So, and I think Justice Barrett, there weren't really any strong hints about whether she would fall more into the Scalia. And I'm sorry, well, of course, Scalia would be definitely where Thomas and Alito are, but whether she will fall with Thomas and Alito or more of a narrow approach that Chief Justice Roberts might join the more liberal members of the court. So let me move to the second issue, which is just a comment a bit on this question of originalism. And I think one thing that's a really kind of interesting question for originalists to ask is whether some constitutional provisions kind of should be approached differently than others. And, you know, obviously, when you say something, when you say cruel and unusual, especially the word unusual, it would seem to suggest that perhaps the founders, the framers, the ratifiers, that they envisioned that it would to some degree change over time in a way. Having soldiers in your home isn't something that's going to be a different question 100 years later, right? And I mean, even things like there should be no law barring freedom of speech or the Second Amendment perhaps have the same implicit reference to variability over time, an unusual punishment would. And of course, if they wanted to, they could have spelled out what practices were cruel and unusual. So, but on the other hand, there is a genuine, a serious concern that having such a nebulous standard of evolving standards of decency basically can lead to the totally unlimited substitution of basically where federal courts and judges substitute their opinion for that of the democratically elected branches. So it is important to kind of cabin this, not so much, I think, because members of the court were that concerned about how this particular case or even this whole issue of juvenile life without parole is resolved, but that obviously a sweeping approach with no way to cabin it could lead to lots of other practices or types of sentences being to be cruel and unusual and a flood of litigation and a role for the federal courts that overwhelms that of the democratically elected branches, or, you know, because in some states, of course, judges are elected, or at the minimum of a state, a federalism issue of basically where there's a greater involvement of the federal government through the federal courts than really was envisioned under our constitutional scheme. So it's a difficult question for that reason.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.